She's gone off this morning and blown her left pupil, and the scan shows diffuse swelling. We thought she might need decompressing. I reached for my computer keyboard. It sounded as though her brain had become so swollen that she was starting to die from the build-up of pressure in her head, the swollen brain being trapped, so to speak, within the skull. A blown pupil, meaning that the pupil of one of her eyes had become very large and was no longer contracting if a light was shone in it, is the first sign of what can be a rapidly fatal process. The fact that she had gone off, that she had become unconscious, meant that if something was not done very quickly to reduce the pressure in her head, she would die within the next few hours, or even less. The scan showed that all of her brain, but especially the left side, was dark with severe swelling. The medical word for this being cerebral edema. The edema was a reaction to the ADEM, although the actual cause of ADEM is not known. Some parts of the brain can be removed without leaving the patient disabled. But if I removed the swollen part of this woman's brain, she would be left hopelessly disabled, unable to talk or even understand language. What about a decompressive craniectomy? The neurology junior asked. This is an operation where you remove the top of the patient's skull to create more space for the swollen brain. It can make the difference between life and death. But there was no point in taking half the woman's skull off if she was going to be left wrecked anyway. She might make a good recovery. Really? I asked. Well, she might do. I said nothing for a while and looked sadly at the scan. I noticed that she was almost exactly my own age. It's not my operating day today, I remarked eventually. I suppose we ought to give her the benefit of the doubt. I said I would see if I could arrange for one of my colleagues to do the operation and made a few phone calls. I settled back to the paperwork again. The operation required was crude and simple, but I would have much preferred to be doing it myself instead of reading reports and dictating endless letters. Like all surgeons, all I want to do is operate. After a while, I went up to the theatres to see how my colleague was getting on. I was puzzled to see that the light in the anaesthetic room next to the theatre, which serves as an antechamber to the theatre, was turned off, and the room was dark. This was most unusual. I pushed the door open and started with shock on entering. There was a shroud-wrapped corpse on the trolley on which patients lie waiting to be anaesthetised. A sheet was wrapped around the lifeless body and tied with a large knot at the top, so that the head was hidden. It looked like a figure from a medieval painting of the Dance of Death. Feeling very uneasy, I walked past the inexplicable corpse and put my head through the theatre doors where my colleague and the nurses and anaesthetists were starting the operation on the woman with ADEM. I found myself in a quandary. Had they had a death on the table? Where did the dead body come from? Deaths during an operation are very rare. I have only experienced that most horrible of surgical disasters 4 times in my career. And the atmosphere in the theatre afterwards was always grim and sombre. The nurses would sometimes be in tears, and I myself would be close to tears, especially if the patient that had died was a child. Yet my colleague and his team all seemed quite cheerful, and I felt were silently laughing at me. I felt too embarrassed to ask why there was a dead body in the anaesthetic room. If there had been a death on the table, I did not want to hurt their feelings by drawing attention to it. So instead, I asked him how he was going to carry out the decompressive craniectomy. He was standing at the patient's head, brilliantly illuminated by the operating lights. Her hair had been shaved, and he was now painting her bare and depersonalized head with brown antiseptic iodine. "Oh, a big bifrontal craniotomy," he said. He was going to saw off the front of the woman's skull in order to allow the woman's brain to swell out of its bony confines. Afterwards, one simply stitches the scalp closed, and if the patient survives, one can replace the bone taken off the skull at a later date once the swelling has resolved. I was feeling very uncomfortable, almost frightened as I talked. I could feel the sinister presence behind me in the darkened anaesthetic room of the shrouded corpse only a few inches away. I asked him what he would do with the falks, the sheet of meninges that separates the two cerebral hemispheres, and which might damage the woman's brain as it swelled out of the open skull. "Divide it, having sacrificed the sagittal sinus anteriorly," he replied. We continued in this technical vein for a while until eventually I summoned up my courage to ask about the corpse. "Oh," he said with a laugh, and the rest of the theatre team laughed with him. "You noticed? It's just an organ donor. A brain-dead head injury from the ITU. Rather what's left of him. That cyclist from two nights ago, he didn't make it despite surgery. Probably a good thing. The transplant team did a snatch last night. Heart, lung, liver and kidneys. They took the lot, all in good nick. They were delighted. They finished later than usual, and the porters were changing shift, so they haven't got round to taking him away yet." Chapter 11. Ependymoma. Noun. A cerebral tumour derived from the non-nervous cells lining the cavities of the ventricles of the brain. There was little operating to do, but much paperwork waiting for me in my office, organised into a series of threatening piles by Gale, I suspect with a certain vengeful glee, since we are in a state of constant warfare, trying to offload paperwork into each other's offices. The many emails from the hospital management I deleted without reading. Among the letters was one from a doctor in a hospital in Lincolnshire asking for my advice about one of my patients, a young woman I had operated upon three times over the preceding 10 years for a brain tumour called an ependymoma that kept on recurring, becoming more aggressive and malignant on each occasion. She had had all the possible radiotherapy and chemotherapy and had now been admitted to her local hospital as a terminal case, with severe headaches from yet further recurrence of the tumour. "Would I have a look at the latest scan," the doctor asked, "and see if anything more could be done, since the family were finding it difficult to accept that the girl was reaching the end of her life?" I had got to know Helen well over the years, and had come to like her greatly. Perhaps that was a mistake. She was always charming and seemed to cope remarkably well with her illness, although sometimes I wondered if that was because she was simply unrealistic about her prospects. Denial is not always a bad thing. Her family were devoted to her, and while thanking me effusively whenever I had seen them, would look at me with such an intensity of hope and desperation that their eyes felt like nail guns fixing me to the wall. "The family have been told by a neurosurgeon in another hospital," the doctor in Lincolnshire had added in his letter, "that if the tumour is operated on again, he can then treat it with photodynamic therapy, and they are desperate that you should do that, so she can then have the treatment." Helen's latest scan accompanied the letter on a CD, and after the usual delays and swearing, I managed to view it on my office computer. It showed extensive recurrence of the tumour in the right temporal lobe of her brain, an area on which in theory I could operate again, but where further surgery, if successful, would only provide a few extra weeks or months of life at best.